Good morning. You've tuned into North Idaho News of the Week here on 88.5 KRFY. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here in the studio this morning with Will Love. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Jack. How are you doing?
I'm great. It's a nice enough day, a little hazy.
Yeah. A little cooler temperatures.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Feels like, you know, maybe a change of seasons is afoot.
Could be. Hey, I got a question for you.
Okay.
All right. Were you more of a school's out for summer guy or, school's back in session?
School's out for summer.
Yeah.
But there is a certain nostalgia for that. Yeah, the especially for college, I think. If you get me in Missoula, Montana at around this time of year or in about a month as the leaves begin to change, it definitely feels like, well, maybe I'll go back and get a, you know, let's get another degree.
Exactly.
Or my first. Let's finish that. Let's finish that college degree. And we're also in the studio with Michaela Law, who is a staff writer for the Bonner County Daily Bee.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Morning, Michaela.
Good morning, Jack.
How are you?
I am well. Thanks for asking.
Good. Will, you are here. You're our summer news host, and then this change of seasons indicates that your time grows short.
Right, right. Yeah. So Monday, contractually obligated to be back in the classroom, and then kind of 8 days later after Labor Day, we'll have students in there.
Okay. First day of school is Tuesday the 8th.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Which made this summer kind of the longest a summer vacation can be.
It doesn't start until after Labor Day.
Right.
This is as late as a Labor Day can be.
Although, you know, we're one of the last schools, I would say, to start because some schools have already been in session since end of July.
I've heard that.
Then in Idaho, Boise started about 3 weeks ago. I know that. So.
Interesting. I'll mention that coming up after we finish up here in the studio, it's time for another edition of North Idaho Climate News with Brad Huta. And he's talking to, I believe, Idaho Fish and Game on the effects of changing weather patterns on local wildlife. So that is right after we turn off the microphones here in the studio. It'll go over to Brad about 8:30. Let's talk about news, therefore, since we have a little bit of a time crunch, more so than we usually
let's
do during
it.
The news show. Let's see. You know, I'm going to start with, since it is a little hazy out there, start with a little weather report, or really a fire report, more than weather. The Upper Smith Creek fire continues to burn in northern Boundary County. It's seen minimal growth in recent weeks, despite Sunday's storm sparking several additional fires near the Upper Smith Creek fire. This is according to the Blue Team, North Idaho Blue Team officials. The fire is holding at the retardant line on Parker Ridge. The three new starts within the Upper Smith Creek's fire's initial attack response area are also being managed by Northern Idaho Blue Team. None of those were over 10 acres. The Canyon Lake fire is 100% contained, and the Pyramid fire sits at 0.04 acres with a helicopter rappel crew assigned, I guess. And then there was the last one was the Parker Lake fire, estimated at 6 acres. But that's the news from the Upper Smith Creek fire, which I believe is still the biggest in our area. And I would only be hypothesizing to say that it might be partially responsible for the widespread haze that we see this morning, that little scent of smoke in the air. In state news, and really kind of state politics news, Scott Herndon, who is the Republican District 1 Senate nominee, has proposed at the Republican Party state level a duty of loyalty bylaw that has currently, I guess, in front of the state of Idaho's GOP Central Committee. This would ensure that committee members, and that would be all committee members, including local precinct captains, support Republican nominees during the general election and voicing support for any non-Republican candidates in a general election when a Republican nominee is on the ballot could be grounds for either dismissal or otherwise some other kind of
reprimand,
I guess. Yeah. There's a rather lengthy piece, I would say, written by Chloe Cochran, going into the, you know, the pros and cons here in the Bonner County Daily Bee from last Friday. This was a big, I think this was the top story last Friday when we were on the news, or the big headline, and we missed it last week.
You can blame it on me, Jack.
Yeah, okay, sure. No, I did. I just, it hadn't made it to the internet yet.
Yeah,
that's how it goes. Let's see. There's a piece that was picked up, I believe, in The Reader and The Bee by Ryan, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. I'm going to say Soupy. Yeah, sure. from Idaho Ed News. This is a website covering education in the state of Idaho, and they do great work.
Yeah, tremendous resource.
Yeah, and he did a real deep dive into the Idaho Tax Commission and their more or less refusal to release private school tax credit data around this is in the wake of that the HB 93, which gave a tax credit to families who wanted to send their children to private school.
Wasn't it up to $50 million statewide?
I believe so, yeah. But there's no, as it says here in the piece, tracking that money has been difficult.
Right. Versus in the article, I read the first part of it, and in Texas, you're able to find out where that money's going, it sounded like.
Anyway, the tax commission kind of coming under fire there, and we'll see if there's movement on that, or, you know, changes afoot as time goes on, I guess. Here in the city of Sandpoint, there's a shakeup actually just down the block from us, down the block from this radio station, where the Music Conservatory of Sandpoint has announced a change of leadership. Karen Wiedemeyer, who is the founder and was the executive director of the Music Conservatory of Sandpoint, has stepped away from her leadership role with the organization, according to a press release from the conservatory. As it says in the press release, the board of directors and truly the whole community is grateful for Karen's transformative vision, dedication, and tireless leadership in building the conservatory into the vibrant school of performing arts it is today, and recognizes her as founder emerita. Conservatory officials said in a press release, I didn't write down here, but going forward, there will be an interim leadership role filled by Kathy Samuels, and they'll begin the search for, I guess, a permanent executive director. Karen has been a guest on this radio station many times, and has brought students with her, and it's been a long and productive career for her over there at the Music Conservatory.
Now, Jack.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Will.
We actually happen to have a reporter here who did a follow-up story on the situation. And do you want to, Michaela, you want to kind of talk a little bit about what you reported today?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I was able to get a hold of Karen and talk to her about her side of the story. And she said that that she didn't consent to stepping down as the executive director. And she told me that in a phone call that she was placed on a forced leave of absence by the school board.
You meant the board of the conservatory.
MCS board. Yes, sorry. Mm-hmm. Should have made that more clear. Yeah, she said that she experienced harassment, which included being accosted in public, spied on, and locked out of her email account. She said that she was asked not to step into the conservatory, and that she was placed under a gag order and told, and she was told that staff were instructed not to talk to her. Something that she told me, and these are her words, she said, "The level of harassment I have experienced and how it was dealt with was so incredibly destructive." She said that her pay was withheld and that she was removed as a singer for the Carmina Burana. I think that's how you pronounce it. Burana. I don't know. But that was a musical concert held earlier this month, at the Panada Theater. And, you know, she spent a long time preparing for that. She spent a year preparing for that and was told at a very short notice that she would no longer be performing. And she said that, you know, this kind of transpired over the course of 8 or 9 months. She said that the breakdown of communication began after she expressed her discomfort with new board member decisions. And she said that after voicing her concerns regarding those decisions, she was met with, quote, strong belligerent behavior. And so, yeah, she... The bottom line is she told me that she didn't consent to stepping down from her position.
Do we know, I guess that is, yeah, that's the bottom line. Does she plan, I guess, what are her plans going forward? I see the word, I see that she's, you know, contacted a lawyer.
Right.
Yeah.
One thing that she had told me the other day, or I guess yesterday, was, you know, I mean, she's still very passionate about this. And so I think whether or not she, you know, continues on with the conservatory or not, she still wants to make sure that she's making an impact in other young musicians' lives. And so that's kind of as much as I know about her plans moving forward. But it sounded like, yeah, when she voiced that she wanted this, the conservatory to take less of a marketing focused approach, she was met with a lot of hostility and pushback from certain board members. So,
So that's I guess the nature of the dispute is over the marketing based approach.
Yeah, yeah. And she was telling me, you know, she's more of a checks and balances kind of gal, and she didn't want too much power in one person's hands when it came to how they distributed their money or what they chose to focus their time and energy on. And, you know, she was saying, as someone who's, you know, the founder of this organization and who has been through the growing pains of this organization, I, of all people, have the authority to speak on this, and my expertise should be taken seriously, right? Like during COVID, she and her board had to think creatively about how they wanted to go about navigating that time, and other hardships that the school has experienced. They've done it without necessarily taking a marketing focused approach. And so, yeah, that's kind of what she voiced to me.
Yeah. The way this, I guess, played out is first there was a press release from the conservatory, which didn't feature any words from Karin, but also didn't make it clear exactly what had transpired, or, you know, that this has been acrimonious. It just kind of said that she had left her role. Karin is now saying that it was not her decision, and she opposed the decision. And now, I guess we'll see if the board has anything more to say about that after the fact, if there's any other, what their side of the story is, what their reasoning was for removing her, since she obviously didn't choose to retire or step down. There you go. That's news at the Music Conservatory, which I don't know. Hopefully, it's a valuable community organization. I hope that they are able to, find themselves on sure footing after the dust settles after this. But let's talk about, if you don't mind, we have to talk about our top story here, which is actually about the city of Sandpoint. The big story in the B, as well as in this week's Sandpoint Reader, is about the budget of the city. Now, oftentimes city budget is not the most exciting kind of thing to talk about, but when it's a record-breaking budget, it is kind of exciting. And then within that story, there's kind of a few other items of significant interest. But the headline is that the city's Sandpoint City Council has adopted a budget of $92 million for fiscal year 2027. It is the largest adopted in the city's history and intends to fund a wastewater treatment plant, which is the city's current highest capital priority. These are your words, Michaela, mm-hmm. from your story on August 22nd. The mayor, Jeremy Grimm, said that the budget represents a concerted investment in the city's infrastructure as it digs out a backlog of deferred maintenance, and goes on to talk, your piece goes on to talk a good deal about that wastewater treatment plant, which has been, a subject of community conversation for decades and a subject of serious focus of this mayor's whole administration. Last fall, by a nearly 89 to 11 in terms of percentage, the city passed a bond measure to fund or to seek funding for the reconstruction of the wastewater treatment plant. I think that's how it's going to go in the same place, but it's going to be a whole new plant, basically. We'll talk about the wastewater treatment plant in just a second, but also I just want to mention that in addition to allocations in the budget, the city is also proceeding with a local option tax which will be on the November ballot asking voters to approve a 1% non-property sales tax for 10 years from beginning January 1st, 2027, all revenues raised being put toward public infrastructure and access improvements throughout the city. Projects would include street pavement maintenance, street habilitation and reconstruction, pothole repair, stormwater and drainage improvements related to streets, sidewalk repair and construction, ADA, pedestrian crossing improvements, bicycle and pathway connections, and more than that. The council voted unanimously on August 19th to approve the ballot language, and Mayor Grimm pledged that City Hall would put together a very educational piece of literature and do a bunch of outreach to some businesses to educate them. That's a quote from Mayor Grimm. This is in light of a similar local option tax that was proposed in 2024 but failed to garner the necessary supermajority of votes. That last local option tax was for 25 years, I believe, or 30. It was a longer term. But aimed at similar things, street improvement mainly, which the city, many critics of city infrastructure say the city needs some better streets. But let's talk wastewater treatment plant and I guess kind of what's developed there. Listeners to this radio station and readers of the paper will already know that the wastewater treatment plant, the city's, which treats wastewater for the city, city residents, and also can have problems due to its age. Was it built in the 50s, I think, or parts from the 50s?
It was before I was around.
Yeah. It's located down on the end of Ellis Street next to the lake, of course. The treatment plant has been, has been a known problem for a long time, and they are planning to fund a replacement for it. Last fall, as you write here, the $130 million wastewater treatment plant bond was approved with 89% support. But there is no federal support for it, which I guess is the kind of news, at least, yeah. The way that's developing. I mean, when the bond was passed, it was passing that bond was in part due to, as it was kind of presented to the public, that passing the bond would allow...
There'd be some matching funds.
There'd be exactly matching funds from the government. There would be grants that could be sought once it was clear that there was voter support for it.
Right.
But they're running into some roadblocks there. Is that fair to say, Michaela?
Yeah. So, there's no federal funding with this project, which is interesting. When I was talking to Mayor Grimm about this, he was telling me that when the... what is it called? Some act got approved 50 years ago, the Clean Water Act or something, was it? I think that's what it was called. Mm-hmm. But when that was passed, cities like ours were able to come to the government and ask for funding.
Mm-hmm.
And the government would fund, like, say, 85% of a project like this, without the city having to pay back any money. And now 50 years later, that's just not the case, you know, and the mayor said that they reached out to the government and asked for funding. And they said, you know, we can't fund projects like this. And largely in part to us being like $40 trillion in debt. That's just not the way that it works anymore. And it is unfortunate. I know the mayor has strong feelings about that too. He told me that it was a misallocation of priorities, and that should be a priority for the government, is to fund wastewater treatment plants, or, you know,
to help with infrastructure.
Exactly, yeah. Because that's integral to cities, right? We need that. And so now, kind of what I explained in the article was that. It's falling on the council to come up with something innovative that significantly reduces the cost of the plant while also still meeting criteria as far as just like state federal criteria, and that's a pretty hefty project.
Now, one of these ideas or one of these alternative options was to reduce the cost by $10 million.
Right. Yeah, with the wet water option.
And what did you learn any more about that? I'm guessing this is related. So it's been pointed out before that one of the big problems that the wastewater treatment plant has is when there is significantly more water in the system than normal. Like right now, the system is okay, but when we get a wet winter like we just did, and especially when there's snow and then rain falls on top of it, the storm drains flood, and it ends up in the wastewater treatment plant system and can overtop those treatment pools. When I read a line that says wet weather treatment, does that mean that they're working on fixing that problem, that particular kind of gap in the system?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I know that it would significantly reduce like the scale and the size of the project.
Which would be nice.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor said that he is actually confident that it would reduce the cost by more than $10 million. But Yeah.
Wet weather treatment. Interesting. Okay. And it still treats and disinfects water, but without a full treatment process. Yeah.
So it wouldn't have to go through an entire treatment process, but it would still meet the criteria that it needs to meet.
Interesting. So does it treat? Well, I guess we'll have to follow up on that to find out what it means. I guess maybe they're treating just the stormwater without treating, or you know, the stormwater goes through a different process than the household sewage does, or something. I don't know. I'm speculating here. That's not official.
One other thing in your story is that you mentioned that an engineer that the city's working with, just what did he say, that his discussions with the DEQ have just been not what he's normally seen? Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so it sounds like they're really supportive of where the city's heading with the project, and they even moved up because they have to get permits approved and stuff like that. So they've even moved that up on like their list of priorities to get that approved. But yes, that's what the engineer was saying, that they're kind of on the same page and really want to, you know, get the ball rolling with this project.
Okay. Is there a timeline or a new timeline or anything?
I can't remember if I put that in my article. Let me see.
Let's see. Let us all peruse the article here for a moment and see. But I didn't see one in the, I guess, in the reader or the B, I don't think. So maybe there isn't one, or not one that's been made public yet. Just to color the story a little bit further, I've heard it said before that the plant has done such a good job with their very limited resources at preventing a total disaster, even though it's come close many times, that actually it's never become a priority for the state, because if the plant were to fail, which seems like it's almost only a matter of time, but if the plant were to have a catastrophic failure, it'd have devastating effects mainly on the communities downriver, you know, Priest River, Laclede, the other, and then into Washington State. But at that point it would obviously become a huge priority to fix the plant. But without that catastrophic failure, the funding is just it's a low priority, because they are managing to kind of hobble by, even though people who have toured the plant are sometimes shocked at the kind of the state of it. It's not in great condition. Let's see. It is just about time for North Idaho Climate News. Is there anything more we should say about the budget? Let's see. They voted unanimously to adopt the budget, so no council members objecting to that, and no real. Everybody's on the same page on the city council, as far as that goes?
Yeah. Councilman Schreiber had some comments, but kind of opposing some things with the treatment plant. But ultimately, he approved the budget.
Anything that we missed here, folks? What else is new? It's a big weekend.
Yeah.
Pondere Neighbor Day.
Yes, there's a triathlon today, actually, a kid triathlon at City Beach that I'm looking forward to.
Are you covering that? All right.
I want to. I think that it'll give us some great pictures. An article that I'm working on right now is about the revitalization plan, phase three of the revitalization plan. So I'll have an article out, but the council members had a lot to say about that.
I imagine they did. Is this phase three? That's where they're starting to move. Which direction is that? Kind of south. South towards the Long Bridge, expanding the area that we would consider downtown, past Pine Street and heading out towards the Long Bridge along First.
Yeah. So what they did during the meeting this week was they reviewed proposed changes to the First Avenue and Superior Street and the Pine Street and First Street intersections. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at different options for that, as well as, so there's a newly scoped section now since they've accepted federal funding. I think they accepted a $1.8 million Local Highway Technical Assistance Council grant. Mm-hmm. And so now that's funding the First Avenue and Bridge Street intersection, which will give them the opportunity to kind of like move around money. And so they accepted or they decided to actually extend the project down to Superior Street.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're figuring out kind of what they want to do between Lake and Superior Street, how they want to go about enhancing that, if you will. Yeah.
Well, we'll read the paper and find out what they come up with there. It's interesting times. I guess that is kind of the direction that you would think downtown needs to expand. And that, I mean, there's, makes sense to me. There's lots of traffic there anyway. I mean, that's where all the cars have to go there anyway. It's not a well suited for a residential street. So, why not turn it into an extended part of downtown? Okay. Well, Will?
Yes, Jack.
Off to the school year?
Off to the school year.
Excited?
Very excited.
Okay.
Always excited. It's been a great summer,
mm-hmm.
but anxious to get back into the classroom.
Cool.
Yeah.
We're going to go over now to North Idaho Climate News. It's an interview with Idaho Fish and Game about the effects of changing weather patterns on local wildlife. And your host is Brad Huta, and that's after an instrumental version of Chet Atkins's, or of Those Were the Days. That's his little theme song there. Kind of a remember when. Okay, thanks for listening to North Idaho News of the Week. Stay tuned now for North Idaho Climate News. Michaela, thanks so much for being here. Michaela Law, staff writer for the Bonner County Daily Bee, has been our guest.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
Thanks, Will. And here we go.
Welcome to North Idaho Climate News, where we discuss changes in climate around the world and how it affects North Idaho weather, lifestyle, and livelihoods. I'm Brad Huta, and this is KRFY. It's a smoky day in North Idaho related to the Spokane Complex fires, which are under control today, but still burning. And today I'm at Idaho Fish and Game to find out how changes in weather patterns and human development may be affecting the animals and fish that live around us. I'm talking today with Laura Fox, who is regional wildlife biologist. Correction, make that Laura Wolf. In the front of the office here, in the front of the building, they have wildlife pelts. And I was just looking at the fox pelt, and so I got that wrong. So it's Laura Wolf, regional wildlife biologist, and Andy Ducks, regional fishery manager. Laura, let's start with you. Can you give me a little bit of your background and what you do here at Idaho Fish and Game?
Sure. I've been a wildlife biologist with Idaho Fish and Game for about 20 years, and I've been here in the Panhandle for 15. I work trying to monitor and survey wildlife populations, especially our big game deer, elk, moose populations. I also do habitat work, working with the Forest Service to try to modify projects that would benefit wildlife species. Most recently, I worked on a wildlife crossing project in the Silver Valley on I-90.
So like one of those overpasses, one of those bridges where the wildlife can cross?
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, great. And Andy, how about you? How long have you been here? What's your background and what do you do here?
Sure. Yeah, so I've been here in the Panhandle since 2008, so I guess about 18 years, and have worked in a couple different roles during that time, but for about the past 11 years, I've been in the fishery manager role, which just means I oversee our fisheries program here in the Panhandle, and that's pretty wide-ranging, everything from doing working with our staff that are doing population monitoring and working with anglers to try to provide the type of fishing opportunity they want, and working with outside partners, all types of things. And the simple way we often say our job is to try to make fishing better.
So that would involve anything from streams to the big lakes?
Yep, all the waters that are within the boundaries here in the Panhandle is where we're focused.
Okay. How do you feel that the current state of the fishery is in North Idaho? How do things look right now?
Overall, I'd say very good. I mean, we have very diverse fish and fishing opportunity here, and so those are obviously varying. Some populations are doing better than others, but overall, we're very fortunate to have a lot of really strong fish populations here, many of which are native species, others that are non-native, but to provide really valuable recreational opportunity. And we have water in this part of the state more so than maybe other places, and yeah. So that is a good thing for fish.
So give me an example of perhaps something that's doing really well and something that may not be doing as well. Does anything come to mind with either of those?
Sure. We have, one of the fisheries we're really proud of right now, I guess, is the Lake Pend Oreille fishery. That's a place we've put a lot of energy into managing over the past 20 plus years. It's a challenging place because we have objectives there to manage for native fish populations, also managing for recreational angling opportunity, much of which is on non-native species. And species that have been more recently introduced that have kind of threatened to upset the sustainability of that fishery. And so we've been doing a lot of work out there to recover that fishery, and we've been very successful at that. And so that's a place where fishing has been very good in recent years, despite some of those challenges that we've had to overcome.
So when you say you do a lot of work, what exactly kind of work is it? I mean, is it like introducing, raising fish in hatcheries and putting those in, or working on the habitat, or what actually is the work?
Yeah, all of the above. I think in the example I'm sharing right now on Lake Pend Oreille, we do stock that lake with kokanee to supplement the wild population. We're doing work to improve habitat around the lake and in tributaries to the lake. But some of the most intensive work that we've been doing has been suppressing non-native predators, namely lake trout, walleye, and northern pike, which more recently have come on the scene, and predation from those species has been, at one time, was enough to collapse the kokanee population. We've been able to successfully reduce the amount of predation out there. Kokanee have recovered, and kokanee then provide not only a popular fishery, but a prey source for a lot of the other fish species in the lake. So. Yeah, there's a lot of different tools in our management toolbox that are getting used in that water body right now.
Okay. What do you see as threats to the fishery now in terms of either human development or in terms of changes in weather patterns?
Yeah, well, I think broadly, whether this is Lake Pend Oreille or really any of the waters here in the region, one of the biggest challenges we wrestle with on the fishery side are introduced species, and quite often those are species that have been illegally introduced by anglers or just people for various reasons, or those illegal introductions maybe that were done in other places. In the example of Lake Pend Oreille, we've had species introduced illegally in Montana that over time have like dispersed downstream and gotten established in Idaho waters. So managing and dealing with the impacts of those introduced species is a big challenge on the fishery side. And then another thing we wrestle with a lot is just, I mentioned this earlier, I mean, fish need water to do well, right? And we're fortunate in the Panhandle, it's a relatively wet place compared to, you know, some other areas around here. But despite that, we still have increasing demands for water with growing population. And on top of that, with some of the changes we've seen in climate over time, this year is a great example. We've had a really poor snowpack. Right now, streams in the area are at near record low levels for summer, and those things can have impacts on fish populations.
I read an article that in Montana they actually close rivers to fishing because of the increasing water temps, and that stresses, especially trout, I guess. Is that something that happens here, and have you noticed changing temperatures of the water?
Yeah, we don't do that here in Idaho, but the same issues are happening. When you get low stream flows, warm temperatures, that tends to be more stressful for fish. We've also done some work, though, that indicates that that issue kind of self-regulates, because in the heat of the day, anglers don't fish as much, they catch fewer fish, and the overall net impact to the populations really isn't that great. So there's different techniques to kind of, I guess, manage that issue between the two states, but certainly there are issues when we have years with low stream flows and warm temperatures that make conditions more stressful for fish. But usually angling's not the driving factor there. It's other things that are causing mortality.
Okay, great. Laura, let's turn to you. What's your assessment of the current status of wildlife in North Idaho?
We certainly have a lot of different species, and it's definitely difficult to monitor all of them across the whole panhandle, but some species are doing relatively well. I mean, bears, lions, deer, even elk in many parts of the region are doing quite well. Other species seem to be struggling, so like moose, which we're seeing population declines across not just Idaho, but much of the lower 48 states. And for a variety of reasons, but changes in weather and climate are certainly something that may be impacting some of these species that we're seeing local declines with.
Can you pinpoint what exactly makes a species do well versus what makes a species, say moose, not do as well? Can you narrow that down to exactly what's going on?
I think that some species that are more generalists are going to do well because they either eat a large variety of food species, forage species, or they cover a wide area of land so they can move around and find what they need. Speaking of species that may not be able to move around as well would be like mountain goats, which have very specific habitat requirements. And so when they have times where you have, you know, really hot, dry summers and their forage may dry up, they do not have the ability to move and find food other places because they're really tied into those cliffy habitats. So that might be more stressful for them.
Okay. I've noticed out behind my place, I live a little bit northeast of Sandpoint, that there's an open field. And I've noticed seeing elk in the evenings this summer. Normally, I only see them in the fall. Does that reflect, maybe it just reflects their movement patterns, but could that reflect decreased forage up in the high country?
It could. They certainly, when they find good forage, are going to stick around those areas. And if you're in an area where there's, you know, houses, then they do have some protection from predators, so that's a safe place to hang out where they're not being chased around, and they have good food. So that's one reason you see animals stick around farm fields or around houses.
Okay. And how do you feel that the weather this last year has impacted those species that you study? In particular, it seems like we had a very mild winter. The snowpack was pretty minimal, and it seems like it's gone already. And is that impacting what you see?
Sure. Yeah, mild winters are very helpful for animals like deer and elk because they're able to find food during the winter. They don't expend as much energy trying to move through deep snow. So you see very high survival with their young, their calf survival, and adult survival over mild winters. But there are other animals that rely on snowpack. So animals like pika or wolverines who create, you know, dens, and they need that snowpack for insulation to survive the winter. They do not do as well when we have mild winters because any of those kind of melting snow, rain on snow events or any kind of melting in the high country is going to put them at risk of being exposed to that cold weather up in high elevations.
So real different effects depending upon how the species lives.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So there's not one, you know, one thing that happens for all species. Some of the weather effects are good for some species and bad for others.
You mentioned something before we started taping that wildfire can actually be good for a lot of the wildlife. Can you explain that a little better?
Sure. Here in North Idaho, we used to have fire events that happened every 100 to 200 years across many of our forests, just naturally with lightning caused fires. And you know, we've had fire suppression for the last 100 years or so. And because of that, many of our forests, especially on Forest Service, our public lands, has grown up, and so we have a lot of closed canopy forest, which if you're walking through those forests, it's pretty easy because there's not a lot of brush and there's not a lot of plant matter, which means there's not a lot of food for many of the species, whether they be berry-eating birds or deer and elk or rabbits or whatever. And so wildfires here tend to cause a reset when the fire has burned. So for instance, if you look at the 2015 Grizzly Fire in the Coeur d'Alenes, the plants that have come back are fireweed, which is a preferred forage species, and we have a lot of willow, which is an aspen that, very tasty plants for animals. And so you can benefit a lot of those species that depend on that type of habitat. So I actually get excited when I see fires burning, as long as the smoke is maybe not sitting right on top of us.
As long as it's not burning hundreds of houses.
I don't want to see houses burn, but when it's safely on the forest and not threatening structures, those wildfires are beneficial to wildlife.
You said that deer and elk are doing well.
In places.
In places, okay. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any impact of diseases that are impacting wildlife? And also, do you see impacts of human development, particularly just driving down? I wonder, are there more roadkill as we see more people moving into this area?
Sure, those are two totally different questions, but since you just said roadkill, we'll start with that. Yeah, so certainly the increase in human population increases the number of vehicles on the road. So you see just more steady traffic on I-90 and on Highway 95 here. And yes, that does impact especially wildlife that maybe doesn't move up in, or spend as much time up in the mountains. So white-tailed deer is probably our number one roadkill that we get recorded on our roadways. But you have a lot of other species that might, coyotes and raccoons and you get moose and elk. There's a variety of species that get hit on the roadway, so that is definitely an impact.
And then what about diseases in these populations? Are you seeing increased vulnerability or different diseases moving into the area that you haven't seen traditionally?
So one set of diseases that's becoming more common, and it is tied to the changes in climate, is these hemorrhagic diseases. So epizootic hemorrhagic disease, which is called EHD, and blue tongue. There are two diseases that mostly affect white-tailed deer, but can affect moose and elk as well. It's a biting fly that breeds in kind of wet mud type habitat. So when we have hot, dry summers and streams and ponds start to dry up, they have a lot more breeding habitat. And so you have a lot more of the midge activity, and they bite the deer, and that can cause localized die-offs, particularly of whitetail.
So that occurs with drought.
Correct.
I guess when you have lots of water, those streams are full, and so you don't have the mud, so they don't have the breeding.
Correct.
Okay. I wouldn't have thought that. How about ticks? Are you seeing problems with ticks?
That's a great question. Yeah, we actually are seeing issues with ticks, particularly with moose who are not able to or don't know to groom them off. Deer and elk are good at grooming ticks off, so they don't tend to have issues with ticks, but moose do not. And so when we have, I think particularly there's an hypothesis that when snow melts off early in the spring, and the ticks fall off the animal. If they hit snow, they're maybe more apt to die, whereas if they hit the ground, they're like hit the ground running and can continue their life cycles. So moose are very susceptible. I think we have been collaring moose, cows, and calves, and in the last couple years, most of our calf mortality is just related to ticks, high tick loads.
Okay, that's interesting. Can you give me an idea of, have you, in the time that you've been here, or related to historical data, how are populations doing, particularly related to changes in weather? Idaho has had documented average increased temperatures of about 1 to 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. What that translates to, though, is not just an average, but we get more heat waves, potentially more drought. And this year in particular, with the El Nino effect happening in the Pacific Ocean, that's projected to cause warmer temperatures and more drought in our area. So what are you seeing now compared to historical averages when things may have been wetter and cooler?
It's hard to disentangle all the different things that might be affecting any one population. So weather is certainly one thing, but like we talked about, mild winters are good for deer and elk, but when you have the hot, dry summers, their forage is likely to dry up early. So I was out actually sampling vegetation yesterday, and many of the plant species are starting to turn yellow, and you lose that nutritional quality once that they start to dry up. So how much does the lack of forage in the summer affect their body condition versus the benefit of not having snow in the winter, right? So it's hard to kind of disentangle all the things that might be impacting them. And on top of that, just land use changes, like I mentioned, like a wildfires or, you know, increase of timber harvest in some places and not others. So there are definitely changes in wildlife. And I think that there are probably things that are affecting certain species more than others, but it's hard to really just pinpoint exactly what is happening.
Okay. And Andy, same question to you. Can you give me a perspective, given your experience historically as well as just historical data, of how are things doing in the fishery compared to previously, particularly with these changes in temperature and precipitation?
Yeah. Well, very similar answer to what Laura just gave. It's exceptionally difficult to kind of disentangle that, and it varies considerably depending on the species of fish that you're looking at. But I guess maybe one thing I could share that's more general is, you know, historically, most of the native fish that would have been here in our area were what we would categorize as cold water tolerant species. So things like cutthroat trout and bull trout, and you know, those fish do well when water temps are cooler and don't get excessively warm in the summer. And so now, where we have more frequent conditions in the summer that are warm, or we have less water, it can be more stressful or more challenging for many of those types of fish species. At the same time, we've had a lot of fish species that have been introduced over time in the region. Good example would be a lot of what we'll call like the spiny ray fish. Think of things like bluegill and perch and bass and walleye. We have a lot of those here now. Some of those are having negative impacts on native fish, but in other places, like, they've been relatively compatible. Clearly, those are fish that people like to fish for, and we're providing that opportunity. Those fish are often in what we kind of categorize as more of a warm water tolerant category. And so they do much better in conditions that are more often warm, which, again, depends on how you want to look at that. If we have a lowland lake that we're primarily managing for warm water fishing opportunity, some of those places are doing quite well. There are other places where some of those species now have a bit of an advantage because they like these warmer temperatures, and it kind of gives them that leg up over some of these native fish that we're trying to sustain on the landscape. So it's super complicated, hard to tease out. And even like what Laura indicated, fish are the same way. There's a lot of, even for cold water fish in the winter time, overwinter mortality is actually a pretty significant source of mortality for fish as well. So if you're living in the St. Joe River in the wintertime and we have a really hard winter, there can be a very high level of mortality for cutthroat trout, and that may be lower in a year that we have really mild conditions, it's not as much ice and all of that. But then that can be contrasted with later in the summer, warm temps and low flow. So it's super difficult to tease it all apart. General statement, what I would say is that at least now we've seen most of our local fish populations are relatively resilient to the suite of environmental conditions we've experienced. But I also have concern that if some of this kind of continues the way it's going, at some point there are going to be some thresholds there that are going to be more impactful.
Okay.
Could I give another example?
Sure,
I was thinking
Laura.
About something that's really visual. So snowshoe hares are one of the few species here that change color. So they're turning white in the winter so that they can blend in and hide from predators. But we are seeing much later snows or much earlier melt-offs. And so I've been out, you know, during the fall hunting, and you see the bright white rabbit in the brown brush. And so that is not beneficial to the hare. But it's probably beneficial to the coyote and the bobcat that is going to find a much easier snack.
Yeah. So it sounds like the changes that may be occurring in the climate are having dual effects. Some are beneficial to some species and habitats, and others are negative. So we can't paint it with a single brush. It sounds like it's more complex. So one last question for each of you. What do you think is most important for people to be aware of and to do to help maintain a healthy environment for natural things in North Idaho? Laura, let's start with you.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think something that people can do easily at their own house is, you know, letting wildlife be wild. So that would be not feeding wildlife. You know, even taking your bird feeders in the summertime when animals start to come around, whether it be bears or deer and elk, so that animals don't congregate and spread disease, and so that they're able to maintain their natural patterns of movement and moving around the landscape as they might, even though we are encroaching in their habitats at times.
Okay. And Andy?
Well, I guess I'll take this opportunity to kind of make a plug for not moving fish species around. It seems like an obvious thing maybe to a lot of us, but it happens far more than you'd think. And oftentimes it's very innocent, right? So you may have an aquarium in your house and the kids decide they're not interested in it anymore. You're going to move or who knows what. And you decide you're going to go to the nearest pond or stream and just let those fish go because you don't want to, you know, kill them or whatnot. And those are things that can be quite impactful. I mean, it's not going to matter if it's a tropical fish, right, that can't survive here, but there are plenty of fish species that do get released, or certainly there's a lot of emphasis right now on things like other aquatic invasives, not just fish, but, you know, the threat of things like mussels, different aquatic plants. Those things often in the kind of aquarium industry can get released into our local waters, or things that are maybe a little bit more intentional where folks are moving a fish from one lake where they really like to catch a particular species and move it to another lake that's closer to home. And those things can be tremendously impactful. Like I said, maybe well-intentioned in someone's mind, but those things can be really negative things that we then have to deal with.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. Those are some really good insights, and I appreciate your comments. This has been Brad Huda with North Idaho Climate News on KRFY. Thanks for listening.